The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
James.
Yes, hello.
So how's the weather down there today?
It's pretty warm. As you might expect Florida to be. Where are you at exactly?
New York City.
Yeah, I've been over many a time.
All right, so if you're ready, we can get rolling.
I am, sir. Oh, hey, you know what? You know what? It would help if I could take 1 second to refresh my beverage. Because as Dave Letterman once said, I believe every man, woman, and child in this great country of ours should occasionally enjoy a lovely beverage. So I'll be right back.
Sure.
Okay, I'm back with you. Sweet iced tea in hand.
All right, so let's get started. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema and music. Today, we take a trip back to the glory days of the Florida death metal scene as we speak with the legendary James Murphy on the Big Papa Online Network. Third Eye Cinema, your source for music and film that matter. Cult, underground, independent, and generally falling outside mainstream corporate boardroom paint-by-numbers bullshit. Tonight on Third Eye Cinema, a true legend in death metal, the one and only James Murphy. The first and perhaps only true guitar hero in the death metal genre, James debuted as a touring member of classic speed metal's Agent Steel, and in short order found himself performing on any number of key albums in the glory days of death metal. Death's Spiritual Hearing, Obituary's Cause of Death, Cancer's Death Shall Rise, and his own Disincarnate with Dreams of the Carrion Kind, as well as being a ubiquitous guest soloist on any number of albums recorded by legendary producer Scott Burns at Florida's Marsan Studios. After appearing on a few well-respected records from Bay Area Thrash's Testament, James turned his hand towards a pair of solo records and a new career in production before hitting a devastating setback no one could have predicted. Now back on track and working as a producer and musician on a number of projects, including a planned Disincarnate album, we chat with James about everything from soup to nuts, from his earliest days in music through the heyday of death metal, and right up to the present day. Join us as we speak to James Murphy, only here on Third Eye Cinema. In our first segment, we'll be talking Scott Burns and historical revisionism, influences, and early days. But first, just to give you an idea who we're talking to, here's James with one of his best-known stints with Obituary. This is Infected.
We'll be right back.
Tonight we have with us one of my all-time favorite guitarists in metal, period. Building a niche for himself in what was then a small and burgeoning scene of death metal, James, alongside producer Scott Burns at Morrisound Studios, practically defined the genre and created what became the Florida death metal scene. With any number of records featuring his unique, melodic, and neoclassically inflected tones on one guest appearance or another, James took guitar chair for some of the universally accepted highlights of the genre, working with such luminaries as Death, Obituary, Cancer, and his own band Disincarnate. Performing additional stints in such early speed metal acts as Agent Steel and Hollows of Eve, and taking part in at least three albums from well-respected Bay Area Thrasher's Testament, please join me in welcoming one of the driving forces of the early 90s death metal scene, Mr. James Murphy. James, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
Glad to be here, man.
So let's start this off with a biggie. You did a tremendous amount of work in conjunction with the great Scott Burns with Morrisound Studios in Florida. Now, in this country, especially back in the heyday of the scene in the early 90s, there really wasn't a whole hell of a lot of death metal that didn't find its way to Morrisound and production under Scott. So I know there's been a revisionist thing in years since that, you know, his style was somehow homogenizing the bands or taking out too many mids, the business about the triggers and the harmonizers. And yet, both at the time and even to this day, if you look back, these bands' best albums, and sometimes the only ones really worth listening to, are the ones that Scott produced. I mean, you know, just think of like Deicide before or after the debut in Legion, or Obituary after the end complete. I mean, hell, Suffocation only made one album without Scott during their original run, and most fans complain about the sound on that one. So tell us a bit about working with Scott and Morrisound.
Yeah, indeed. It was really good times to be working with Scott in those early days, and I really don't know the whys and wherefores that he ended up leaving the business, but it was a seminal time, definitely for me. It helped form my, you know, my decisions to get into the production side of things, and it was just a really, really, really good time. And, you know, I'm familiar with all of the old, you know, canards that people throw at Scott, you know, sort of post hoc, but he was the first really respected metal producer. And a lot of metal producers have sort of gone through that sort of cycle that he went through. And I think it's sort of human nature, you know, for people to sort of glom onto the hot new thing, and then they sort of feel like it's getting used up, so they feel like they need to discard it. And, you know, then afterwards, they have sort of a revisionist history that takes place. But the reality is, you could take any number of albums Scott did and play them, and none of them really sound the same at all. Were there elements that maybe were recognizable as a signature, a Scott Burns signature per se? Perhaps. But I think maybe the main thing is just that you could always pretty well hear everything, and it was usually pretty powerful, and that was something that prior to him, death metal bands just simply didn't enjoy the opportunity to have, you know. And it, you know, quickly some of the other producers started dipping their beaks in that source of work and income. Scott came into doing death metal, I think, very, very, very organically. I mean, he was a punk rock kid who started as a really young guy at Morrisound, and as a punk rock kid, he always had an affinity for heavier, more harsh, more intense sounds than what the other producers working at Morrisound were accustomed to working with. So he got handed these jobs eventually, and he took them and he flew with it. And he had a great affinity for the music, not too far removed from, you know, what he was really into himself. And a lot of guys that came later, sure, Andy Wallace started doing some extreme metal and death metal, like, you know, Sepultura and what have you.
Colin Richardson
came on the scene and started doing Carcass. But, you know, I mean, these guys were not, they didn't come from it, and they didn't cut their teeth on it. Scott did, and he was the first one to do it. And he was the first real producer to sort of signal to the rest of the world of producers out there, guys like Colin Richardson and Andy Wallace and ultimately guys like Andy Sneap and et cetera, that right. There was, in fact, a market for this kind of music. There was, in fact, a following, and that these type of bands wanted to have better production, and
right.
that there were labels that were willing to put the bill for that. So Scott was, you know, he was a pioneer of it. I think he's referred to alternately as the legend of the scene, and sometimes, you know, spoken about as though he somehow were generic or this, that, or the other. And I think the former is far more true than the
latter. Right.
Emphatically that. I mean, he's far more accurately seen as a legend of the scene than as any kind, you know. Now, one problem that Scott had as he became more and more popular and more labels started signing more and more bands.
Right.
He started getting smaller labels, and, you know, the bigger labels with more money didn't, you know, only had X amount of artists, and smaller labels started getting into it and sending bands his way. And, you know, sometimes budgets were just not as good. Like, you know, I mean, the Spiritual Healing, for instance, had a pretty good budget for the time. But, you know, I'm sure albums like Atrocity Album, like Hallucinations or whatever, yeah, didn't necessarily have that kind of budget. So while it's a really cool record, it probably didn't, you know, Scott had nothing like the time, the amount of time to work on it. So the great thing about Scott is that he took you no matter what your budget was. If he made a deal to do it, if he was able to get a deal with the studio, because, you know, he didn't own the studio. He had to work out the financials with the people who owned the studio and everything. And,
right.
and so if he could work it out where he could just scrape by, he would. And he would make it happen for the band. And you know, he'd put in the hours. And some stuff had to be done a lot quicker than other things. And, you know, and I think his willingness to take on any budget and make it happen really was, you know, a blessing for those bands, but probably ultimately a curse for Scott. I think it burnt him out, and I think it perhaps over, you know, flooded, like, his name as a producer on the market on a lot of albums that weren't necessarily his best work, simply because they had no chance to be. They didn't have the budget, and therefore didn't have the time at the studio. And again, you know, the amount of time that the studio could allot was not in, you know, Scott's power to, you know, he did not have that discretion. The studios were owned by, you know, Tom and Jim Morris. So, you know, he did what he could, and I think he was, for the bands that he helped in that regard, he was a hero, you know?
Yeah, and we're definitely on the same page, because, you know, I'm from the old school. I was around, I'm almost the same age as you. I was around for the early days of this stuff. And, you know, whenever I heard of Scott Burns production, I knew it was his signature. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I thought that was like, okay, this album sounds good. I know I'm safe with this. Let me give it a shot, as opposed to, you know, even like a Colin Richardson, you never really knew what you were going to get.
Yeah. Well, as I said, you know, and I'll go back to what I said earlier, the real signature for me was is that you could always hear everything. There's always a nice, clear sound. You know, perhaps on some of the albums that he had to a clear and powerful sound. Perhaps on some of the albums he had to do more quickly. He had less time to sit around and make discretionary choices about, say, for instance, what to do about a kick drum sound or what have you. And so he had to fall back on familiar crutches. I can tell you, as a guy who's worked in the trenches of producing extreme bands now for almost 20 years myself, that happens when budgets are low and schedules are tight. There's almost no way around it. You know, sometimes there's crutches that you have to fall back on. So when you have the decent budget and or you have the time to devote, and, you know, you can really take the time to craft something a little more special. But at the end of the day, as long as the music is great and the sound is clear and powerful.
That's all that matters.
And yeah. I think Scott did, you know, deserves his reputation as a legend, I think, of the scene. And I think is over-criticized by some people who are not really aware of the actual dynamics of, you know, the dynamics he had to work in, the dynamics of the situation, budgets, time constraints, and pressures that he had to work under, you know.
Exactly. And also what you said before about revisionism, a lot of this is just basically people, I don't want to say hipsters, but, you know, people being embarrassed of where they were, or saying, like, oh, well, everybody else loves this, so I've got to hate it. You know, it's almost like a pose. Like, well,
yeah.
No, take a look at the material and then tell me what you really think.
No, there's always a certain amount of that. But yeah. I think, for instance, Spiritual Healing is just one example of multiple albums that Scott did that is a prime example of how good a death metal album could sound in the very early 90s, before anyone was using Pro Tools. And how good it could sound in the early 90s when a dedicated professional like Scott, who had a fire for the music and a love for the bands, was able to have the time to really craft something great. And he had the songs, you know, the material and musicianship at the same time to work with. Magic happened.
And just to close this part out, you know, I really think that between Scott's production, your guest solos, which were all over the place, and some guest spots from the likes of Glenn Benton on a number of records, there would have been no death metal scene in the U.S. because it really was, you know, if you look at 90% of what was coming out at that time, it was always at Marsound in Florida or Sunlight in Sweden and Colin Richardson in the U.K. who made any real waves with the general public.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's totally true. You definitely hit the three key areas of the three key producers and three key studios, no doubt about it. With any one of those three gone, there still would have been a movement, still would have been a death metal today, but it wouldn't have taken hold as well as it did. I mean, that was the death metal trifecta, you know, the triad is a better word, yeah. Between those three locations, those three producers, those three studios. Well, I think Colin always worked at multiple studios, but, you know, you get the...
Let's go back to the beginning. Who were your inspirations? Because your style is kind of unique.
I had a weird set of inspirations. I was definitely always more interested in songs. Songwriters were my very first influences. Tony Iommi, probably my first songwriting influence. Sort of went from there. But, you know, lead playing-wise, you know, it's an interesting thing, both for songwriting and lead playing. I wanted to play guitar for many years longer than I actually did, you know, before I was able to. I started asking for guitars at about age 7 or 8. Every birthday, every Christmas, any sort of occasion that I could possibly have a reason to expect presents, I always asked for a guitar, and I was never given one. So I never really got my first, you know, guitar of my own, a proper playable guitar.
Right.
I mean, I had toy guitars and some old banged up, beat up guitars when I was younger that, you know, really weren't playable or even tunable. But I got my first proper guitar that I was able to actually start really learning on when I was in high school, and I was able to work. And actually, I was living in Germany and going to high school, and I worked summer job at what was called the Dependent Youth Employment Program. You know, I was an Army brat, and there were a lot of jobs for what we were called dependent youths. We were dependents. Our fathers or our mothers were in the military. So they had families lived over there. I lived over there with just tons and tons and tons of American families, and went to school with American kids at an American high school in Germany. There were programs in the summer when school was off that the Army would give part-time summer jobs to dependents.
Right.
And I worked one of those. I worked at a helper to the maintenance guy at a NCO club, a non-commissioned officers club in Gießen, West Germany. And I saved all that money. And in addition to that, I went around into our housing complex and mowed lawns. I saved that money for that whole summer. And then I went into Gießen and bought my first really decent guitar. And so I had that for my senior year. And that's when I really started really learning, was my senior year of high school. But what I had to my advantage, that may seem like a disadvantage, but I think I was able to parlay it into an advantage because, like I said, I really wanted a guitar, and I was really into music from about age 8. I mean, I quit playing with regular toys, and my 10, 11-year-old friends would be, you know, playing with Star Wars action figures, and I would a little bit just to join in with them, but when I went home, I sat and listened to music. That's all I did, and, you know, I wasn't allowed to make noise really that much, so I would sit with headphones in this little corner. Like, my turntable was on my dresser. I would sort of sit in the corner made by that and the wall, with the headphones trailing down off the top of it on my head, record spinning, Queen, Aerosmith, AC/DC, Black Sabbath, Rush, Kiss, And I sat and just listened to these records. You know, they wouldn't buy me guitars, but they would buy me a record album. And I got enough of an allowance from doing my little chores that I was able to buy record albums from time to time. They weren't that much. So I sat for just hours and hours and hours on end doing nothing but listening to music. And I would just go into a trance, and I knew so many songs so well, inside and out, every little nuance of them, the right. arrangement, the harmony. Even though I didn't understand harmony, I knew what it sounded like. The arrangements, I knew every little nuance of the solos. I could hum them in minute detail, including every nuance of the vibrato, the bends, everything. And so I had internalized so much music, but that by the time I was able to have a decent guitar and able to sit down and start actually physically learning the mechanics to play, my mind already knew what it was trying to tell my fingers to do, and I advanced really rapidly. I was able to make that sort of, you know, as a teacher, I taught guitar for years afterwards, and I would always tell my students, you know, hey, you know, you're just mechanically trying to do this. You need to make a connection between what you're hearing in your head and your fingers. Once those synapses snap together, you know, and lock, things like vibrato and bending and all that stuff really come a lot more naturally. Your mind is telling your fingers what to do on a musical level, not just on a mechanical level. And so I advanced really rapidly, I think, because of that. So my early influences were Tony Iommi, AC/DC, ultimately like Randy Rhoads and things like that. I think the first solo by another lead player that I ever learned how to play was You Shook Me All Night Long. I still play that solo sometimes to this day. It's super simple to play now, but back then it was a major feat for me to learn that solo. And I just remember I learned in that like such a weird way where I knew that solo so well before I ever tried to figure out the mechanics of playing on the guitar that it came so easy. I was doing vibrato before I knew what vibrato was. That bend, bam, you know, and you hit that vibrato. And I was doing that before I even really knew what the hell I was doing. And I remember a funny story about that because my father was a really strict military guy. He didn't even let us have doors on our rooms. I mean,
wow.
He took the doors off our rooms and stuck them in the storage room downstairs. So I remember my sister was just about 3 years younger than me. And I must have been 17, sitting in my room playing this AC/DC solo right after I had just learned it. And she came in and she sort of leaned against my door jamb and crossed her arms. And she just gave me that look like only like sort of sister can, like, what the hell are you doing, you know? Looking at me down her nose, eyes crossed, just staring at me, and I just kept right on playing, and I finally just stopped and said, hey, what's up? And she goes, why are you wiggling your fingers like that? And I just sort of thought about it for a minute, and I was like, well, because it sounds cool. And she just continued this deadpan, stared at me down her nose, leaned a little bit forward, and said, well, it looks stupid, and walks off, you know? And then, you know, and I was sitting there going, well, I guess I don't really care about that. But, but that's how I learned, you know, in that sort of environment where isolated myself in this world of music. And it took me a long time to be able to get a guitar. But I had so many influences musically before I ever really had an outlet to process it, you know, physically.
That actually sounds like very similar to the way I started out, because I was listening to music voraciously for years before I finally... It was actually hearing Randy Rhoads, I forget which solo it was, it might have been Mr. Crowley even, and Carlos Santana. They played them both on the radio at the same day, and I'm like, you know, I'm actually feeling this, and I want to do this now, as opposed to like, hey, you know, maybe I should play guitar, and that might be too hard, whatever. It's like, no, now I want to do this. I've got to get this out.
And
once I started, I actually had like a poster that had like the modes and the scales and chords and things like that. So by the time I actually started taking guitar lessons, again, we're talking about the same time period, like I was 18 or so, I actually rapidly advanced. And the guy's like, well, you're too good for me already. Within like a couple of months, go find a jazz teacher. This is my first guitar teacher. So it's the same idea. You know, it's like I already knew what I wanted to get out, but, you know, I was just kind of getting at it naturally from all these influences. So I know exactly what you mean. You've got to feel this. You got to have some kind of basis before you can, you know, unless you just want to do this mechanical kind of, you know, up and down the scales thing, which people do it and people think it's great, but it's not really where I'm feeling it.
Yeah, it's not particularly music. And that's coming from a guy, you know, again, just like you, who did a whole lot of that just to sort of develop my chops. But
exactly.
What came before was really just internalizing music and then just expressing it purely on the instrument without really knowing what the hell I was doing. You know, songwriting too. And I remember the first riff I ever learned. You know, a lot of people say Smoke on the Water. For me, it was Iron Man. I remember, man. Well, I could play the riff to Iron Man, and a friend of mine came over and I was like, yeah, check this out. And I played it along with the along with the cassette. And he was
right.
Like, dude, you're awesome. Like, it was like the only thing I could play. I was actually, you know, pretty horrible still at that point, but I remember, you know, that just really bolstered me, and I thought, yeah, you know, I am pretty awesome, you know. You know, to more explicitly answer the question, you know, Angus Young, Randy Rhodes, Tony Iommi, Alex Lifeson, right. To a certain extent, he was always a little bit over my head, but back then, but yeah, he still was an influence. Ace Frehley, Kiss, started, you know, learning about sort of the shrapnel guys as they sort of came to the fore, like, you know, starting with Yngwie and then Tony McAlpine and Paul Gilbert and Vinnie Moore and all those guys. And I, you know, have had the fortune to, you know, to work with a lot of those guys, you know, later on in my career.
I was such a huge fan of shrapnel guys, particularly Racer X and Vinnie Moore, who I actually met Vinnie Moore. He was cool.
And he's a great guy. Yeah.
Nobody knew who I was talking about ever. It's like you had to be a guitarist to know these people, but they were so good.
Yep.
And the funny thing is, what I was going to say before is I know exactly what you're talking about with your friend coming over and thinking you were great when you didn't really know what you were doing yet.
I
learned Motor Breath from Metallica, and I had a friend, he actually called his house and put like his brother on the phone, was like, listen to this, and had me play it to him. Anyway. Listening to Third Eye Cinema with a special guest tonight, James Murphy. In our next segment, we talk his soloing style, Agent Steel, Hallows Eve, and the lead up to death, only here on Third Eye Cinema.
This is Adam from Tribulation, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hi, everybody. Hi, everybody. Shall I start again? Okay. Hi, everybody. Alex from Atrocity. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Enjoy the day.
What's always been interesting to me is that you seldom rip over a fast rhythm or whatever. You always have this kind of thing where the band pulls back the pace, and you do this laid-back, very melodic, reverb-suffused, almost like a lackadaisical run of arpeggiated chords mixed with a few whammy bar dives, and then some faster neoclassical lines thrown in to break things up. And you tend to stick strictly to the meter with these lines, which strikes me as kind of Baroque in orientation, while the other material is more legato. And then you top off the whole thing by double or triple tracking like Randy Rhodes. So, you know, it always stands out. You're one of those guitarists that immediately you can pick it out and say, oh, it's James Murphy. So where did you develop all that from?
Well, I don't know. It's just an amalgamation of my influences. I would say some of my later influences that really sort of informed my playing as I was getting closer to my actual first recordings, you know, which actually my very first professional recording ever was Spiritual Healing. The players that really informed my playing then was my whole, you know, back catalog of influences, which we just talked about. But then there was just a couple of guys, you know, around here on the Florida scene that when I got back to Florida from Germany, it was late 1984, about to turn 1985. I started going to local shows in the Tampa, Brandon area. And, you know, I started seeing bands around here like Sabotage and Nasty Savage. And I was extremely influenced by Chris Oliva and Dave Austin of Nasty Savage.
Really? Because I don't care about Nasty Savage. I'm not picking that up. Where does that come in?
Nasty Savage is more like sort of the cool octave slidey and bar type stuff, trippy bar stuff that Dave would do. Now, Oliva, he was also an influence for that sort of the octave slide, like doing cool melodies by sliding octaves around and getting the bar involved with it. And I think Chris Oliva was the very first influence on that. And then Dave sort of took that and flipped it on its ear, twisted it a little bit, and made me go, ah, I can get even trippier and cooler. You know what I mean? That's when I started doing a lot of the really weird, expressive stuff. So, you know, I stole it from those guys, blended it together, and, you know, mixed it with all my other influences and pulled it out of my ass as my style, you know, which is kind of what everybody does, really. And I wouldn't say you're dead on about part of your analysis there, where it sort of usually, normally, wouldn't play over the really super fast parts. It would sort of kick back a little bit. But that had more to do with sort of the songwriting style of Death and Obituary, and those were the first two albums that I got most known for. That just sort of was the way the songwriting happened. I was not part of the songwriting process on Cause of Death. But I was on Spiritual Healing, and it just seemed natural. If we had a fast verse, if we had a big, heavy, brutal chorus, that, you know, you needed to take a left turn for the solo, you know, rather than just soloing over the verse riff or soloing over the chorus riff. I know I felt that way, and I know Chuck did too. Nothing spelt boring quicker than, you know, soloing.
Exactly.
The same damn riffs that, you know, you just sang over.
And I think that's a lot of what makes it stand out, too, is this change. Like, whoa, what's this? He's out of left field almost.
You want to add extra depth, gives you something. And the thing is, it is more fun to solo over actual changes. On really fast parts, it's usually, especially in extreme metal, usually fast stuff is just sort of a really repeated riff. There's often a lot of chromatic stuff in there because people are just a lot of fast notes. Really hard to solo over that, really hard, because it just doesn't go anywhere. When you kick it back a little bit and start doing some changes, the rhythm progression has time to develop. There's actually, you know, harmony in that rhythm progression that's moving from one place to another as the chord changes, and it allows you to express something in the solo, to actually tell a little story, to make a little vignette, you know, inside the song.
That's actually kind of my problem with black metal, which I love, but it tends to be very static, despite the fact that they're going very fast, and you got all these kind of...
I love black metal, too.
Yeah,
I like the most raw, nasty black metal ever, and I just don't even care if they have solos or not.
But there's really no harmonic progression half the time.
Sure.
It's just gonna, you know,
exactly,
it's static.
Exactly. So. A lot of time that's true, especially with the really raw, primitive stuff that's primitive on purpose. I love it for that. But exactly. One thing that I would say that you're not necessarily 100% accurate about on the analysis of my earlier stuff, definitely I made a big effort, especially on Spiritual Healing. I was probably way more true what you said about me always sort of being in very, you know, metric to, you know, what was going on rhythmically. And I think that's very important. You know, it's music after all. But I would say sometimes on the Obituary record, for instance, you know, I would sometimes, you know, start on time, hit a couple keynotes on time in the middle, end on time. But sometimes there was some crap in there that was just floating around.
I had this idea,
you know, and it wasn't like, I wasn't like being real deep and jazzy or anything. I was just like, damn it, I want to fit this lick here. The fact that it doesn't fit, be damned. I'm just going to do it. You know?
And that's what I was saying. You do have these.
Make it sound cool, damn it. You know, and, you know, luckily, you know, people generally feel I succeeded in that. I sometimes listen back to those solos and cringe.
You know? You do have these legato phrases in there, like I said, but, you know, overall, it tends to be at this kind of baroque, very on the meter, chop, 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 and then it'll sort of flip back and forth. And, you know, just in terms of your influence, on me, personally, you can hear a little of your influence bleeding in on my show's theme music, particularly in the later bumpers and outro with the solos, because, you know, you've always been one of my all-time favorite players.
I appreciate that very much.
Your style was pretty well defined right from the beginning on the Agent Steel DVD for Mad Locust Rising, for instance. But strangely, with that one, the camera tended to focus on Jay Westlord throughout most of it. So what was that all about?
I don't know. I really don't know about that. I have to say that when I was on stage, I was... This is what you got to understand about that show. I was, I don't know, maybe 17 or something. I was really, really young. I did not want to be wearing that ridiculous jumpsuit getup, you know, which was frankly quite prescient of Slipknot, you know, many years in advance.
Right.
You know, but at the time, I couldn't have been more appalled at being expected to wear that getup. And frankly, I really suffered through that whole show because, you know, we were sort of forced by the band leader to put that getup on. I was just hired as a touring musician, you know, for that.
Right.
Band. And I was so anti wearing that stupid getup that I put on like jeans and a t-shirt underneath it. And my plan was, because I had to walk underneath all that stage rigging. And if you see on the video that big like 3 or 4 tiered stage rigging with all the lighted panels and those symbols on it that were like the symbol from the cover of Unstoppable Force. Those symbols were put on with electrical tape, by the way. That stage was rented from, believe this or not, Gary Numan.
Seriously?
In cars, here in my car.
Wow.
We rented that stage get up from Gary Newman's people. And the singer of Ace of Steel got out there with electrical tape and put those little symbols all over it. Dressing rooms were down below stage left, house right. And I was, during the show, I had to be on stage right, house left was my side of the stage. So I had to walk underneath all that stage rigging to get to my side. And I was so embarrassed about those stupid outfits that my plan was to stop about halfway through, because I knew I had about 10 minutes to head out a few minutes early so that I could stop, shed that stupid jumpsuit, and just show up on stage in just my jeans and a t-shirt. I ended up being just, I stopped and I was thinking, I was getting ready to do it, and the thought flashed in my mind, like, you know, I just don't know. I mean, this singer's kind of cuckoo, and I just don't know what kind of crazy thing he'll do if I defy him that openly at this show. So I was already, you know, just embarrassed about that. And one other thing you have to understand about it was that was exactly my, let me see, fourth time in my life ever playing in front of people. And it was headlining the Hammersmith Odeon. The first time was at a junior high school variety show. I was in high school. The people I were playing with, I was playing with were in junior high, my friends, because I had started so late that all my friends in high school were better than me.
Right.
I had to play with junior high school kids, so I played their variety show instead of the high school variety show. It was a junior high school variety show when I was in high school in Germany, and then two gigs playing cover, which was, we played like two or three cover songs, and then maybe 2 years, 3 years later with some friends playing covers at a bar in Louisiana two different nights. So that was my stage experience before walking on stage in London, England, headlining the Hammersmith Odeon with a massive stage production of multi-camera video shoot. I had never had video cameras in my face before. I was shitting my pants. Or I was shitting my silly orange jumpsuit. You know?
Wow.
You know?
You know, I was wondering, it's like, was there something in the contract saying you'd be kept out of the spotlight for some reason, or was there some kind of ego thing going on?
No, I really don't think it was. I think it was just, you know, poor editing and poor shoot, probably. There may have been, and who knows, technical things sometimes go wrong. There may have been something wrong with the camera on my side part of the time. You just really know. Like, they may have had technical issues where they didn't have enough footage on me because some malfunction. But I don't really know. I don't really care. Probably at the time, if I would have known it was happening when I was on stage, the thing is, I didn't care. I was terrified of the cameras. I remember I stepped up one time to take my solo, and a cameraman comes lunging towards me from a little bit of a jog to sliding on his knees up in front of me to get the shot, you know? And I crapped myself and screwed up the first few notes of the solo because of it, because I wasn't used to that sort of thing. I was a teenager, you know. I didn't know, playing my fourth time ever live and, you know, mortified out of my brain. It wasn't a big deal to me being in Europe. I had been in Europe for years. You know, I had lived there for years, so I didn't really, you know, that wasn't a big deal. But the fact that I was on the stage at Hammersmith Odeon, a legendary, I mean, you know, one of my favorite live albums of all time was No Sleep to Hammersmith, plus multiple other live albums that were recorded at the Hammersmith Odeon. I was well familiar with that venue before I played it, and, you know, it's legendary. So I was crapping myself, and like I said, probably from immediately after that show when I would have actually been able to think, string two cohesive thoughts together because I wasn't able to on stage, probably from immediately after that show, as soon as I got my wits back to me, to this day, I'm more grateful than anything that I'm underfeatured on that video.
You know, on the plus side, just in their defense, I got to say, I really love those first two Agent Steel records, Skeptic's Apocalypse and Mad Locust Rising.
Sure.
They really stand out in the speed metal scene, and John's vocals seem to have held up to this day. But, you know, it had to be difficult to work with John Cyrus from everything I can tell. The only members who managed to stay with him for any length of time were himself, Chuck Profus, and Juan Garcia. And even with Juan, we're only talking two albums prior to the reunion in 99. Chuck was probably the longest standing member outside of John. And then the band self-destructed right after that tour. And then you got another gig touring with Hallows Eve. So tell us
about
that.
I actually did not tour with Hallows Eve. Really? I'll tell you, I'll take it. Yeah. Came back from, I signed on to do that European stint, and that was it. John, the singer that you're talking about, yeah, he was very, very, very difficult. I don't mind saying that to this day, and, you know, I don't think that I'm, you know, talking smack or trying to be mean-spirited towards him. I'm not, you know, it's all water under the bridge. I harbor no lingering resentment, you know, more than 20 years later. I mean, that was 1987, man. So I harbor absolutely no resentment 25 years later. But facts are facts, and they're well known. They got themselves in the newspaper after that tour. I mean, it's not... I'm not letting a cat out of the bag or or letting skeletons out of closet. They've already been out of the bag, and you know, the skeletons were, you know, paraded in front of the world for a short period after that. But, yeah, he was difficult. He was quite a character. I think that he probably needed help, and I hope he got it. you know, he actually wanted to brand everyone in the band, and he succeeded by making up the story that we all needed to get these Agent Steel tattoos, like a brotherhood. And I knew I wasn't going to be in that band. You know, I was just like, man, I'm just doing this tour, and I'm out of here. I already couldn't handle it, you know, and I was just like, I'm just going to do the tour. So, no, I'm not getting the tattoo. I'm not getting the tattoo. And he was like, no, we all are. I am, too. And, you know, just he actually got everyone that was on that. You mentioned, you said Jay Westlord. He's a guy. His name is John Reichenbach. That was his actual name. The singer John dubbed him G. Westlord for the metal factor, apparently, for some reason. Westlord was considered in 1987 by John Cyrus as more metal than Reichenbach. But I don't know. I mean, Reichenbach sounds pretty fucking metal.
Yeah, exactly.
But John got the tattoo, John Reichenbach, you know, Westlord. Even Richard Bateman got the tattoo. Chuck Profus got the tattoo. I refused. And guess who else pulled a fake and didn't get the tattoo?
John Cyrus. Wow.
His actual name's John Camps, by the way, but or perhaps Juan Camps, because he's Brazilian. He's not even American.
Right.
Which, you know, that's not a problem. It's perfectly fine that he's from Brazil, but he certainly liked to try to hide it back in those days. I do not know why. There's nothing wrong with being from Brazil, but he certainly behaved like there was. You know, Brazil's a great country, and I got lots of friends there, and I love to visit there, and I love to play there. And
exactly right.
But for some reason, he did not like people to know that he was from there, and he hit it. Anyway, well, it kind of dovetails. When I came back from that tour, I refused to get the tattoo, and it caused such a fuss that those guys all sort of ran off. They went and had a little meeting because I wouldn't get the tattoo, and then they threatened me to get the tattoo. And so I started packing my stuff in my car to go home. And this was like 2 weeks or less before embarking on the European tour. They had no time to replace me. And so they ended up calling me up, or Chuck Profus did, and said, no, it's cool. You don't have to get that tattoo. Everything's cool. You know, John wanted me to tell you it's cool. You don't have to get it. And I was like, yeah, I know I don't have to get it. But if he's cool with it, you know, okay, I'll come back. I'll do the tour. I would like to do the tour.
Right.
And so I came back and I did the tour. And while I was over there, when I came back, they did try to talk me into staying in the band, but I did not. I refused. Did finally manage to get my gear back from them, and that's when they headed out on their journey across the states to go back to California, and that's when they got arrested somewhere for crazy weirdness. And I ended up reading about it in the paper. I was like, oh, my goodness. But, that experience kind of put me off, you know, the music business for a little bit. I did enjoy, you know, hanging out with Nuclear Assault on that tour, and you know, I made friends with them despite being ordered not to. I did anyway. I was told by John Cyrus, you know, to be mean to and to ignore Nuclear Assault and those guys. But me being me, the second I was alone with any of them, I immediately was like, oh, hey, dudes, I have nothing to do with that. I love you guys. Game over fucking rules, you know.
Right.
And they were like, oh, okay, cool, dude. Come on up to our fucking hotel and hang out with us. You know, so I went to their room, you know, hung out, did most of my hanging out with them.
Right.
And, you know, so I had good times on it. But, there, you know, as far as the way I was dealt with on that tour from a business standpoint and a professional standpoint from that band, I was really put off. And so I decided just to teach guitar lessons for a while. Eventually, I decided to, and this sort of dovetails into the Hollows Eve thing, this is where when I came back from that tour, I was teaching guitar lessons for a while, and then I just sort of felt like that was stagnating. And you know, I couldn't just sit around in my hometown anymore after having sort of tasted touring and how it could be hanging with cool guys like Nuclear Assault. Like, man, I get in a band like that where everyone's cool, you know, and tour, you know, and have a good time. That's what I want to do. That's, you know, my dream. So I thought maybe perhaps I needed a little more schooling, you know, and there was a school at the time in Atlanta called the Atlanta Institute of Music. It started life, I think, as the East Coast MI. The East Coast Musicians Institute. And then I think it splintered, you know, just sort of broke off on its own and became Atlanta Institute of Music, its own, you know, separate entity. And my idea was to move to Atlanta and become a student there and perhaps jam with a local band. So, you know, I started looking around in Atlanta classifieds and talking to people that I knew, and somehow I connected up with Dave Stewart, the guitar player from Hollows Eve.
Right.
And I started talking with him, and he said, look, well, you know, Hollows Eve is kind of done. But, you know, maybe we're going to try to do, you know, get it back together with new people. We would need another guitarist because, you know, whatever other guitar player they had or that just had moved on. So they were like, well, we're either going to make a new band with a new name or we're going to do a Hall of Eve. It really sort of depends on what Metal Blade has to say. And, you know, and I was sort of like, I was really itching to do a record. And I thought, well, you know, these guys have been on a record label. And so even if I make a new band with them, it would be kind of cool. And I can go to AIT at the same time. And so I moved up there, and I became roommates with Dave Stewart and got a place, and we fixed it up, and we became roomies. And I got a job at a landscaping company with the idea that I would start going to the school as soon as I had saved up some money. But I ended up only really being there 5 months. I was never able to get up the money in time to start a semester at the school, and I didn't really have time. Hall of Eve never managed to put together a lineup, although we did get together for a few jams. We never really resolved whether we were going to actually call it Hall of Eve or something else. We never really had a solid drummer. We had this one dude we, you know, jammed with a couple times. We probably jammed together only 3 or 4 times, and we just never really made a solid decision on whether it was going to be Hall of Eve or a new band. And that's where I was at when, you know, when Chuck called me for Death. So it just didn't really... never really materialized as Hall of Eve or anything else. It sort of materialized as a loose group of guys featuring a few Tommy Stewart and Dave Stewart, ex-members of Hall of Eve, that may or may not call themselves Hall of Eve and may or may not get a record deal. And it was still in that sort of indecisive, formative stage where we really didn't know what we were going to call it when the call came in from Chuck. And being as that I had been unable to start the school and was working a really miserable landscaping job, and, you know, Hall of Eve hadn't really gone anywhere, I ultimately decided to take Chuck up on his offer. But the weird thing was, is out of some weird sense of loyalty to Dave and Tommy from Hall of Eve, I initially turned Chuck down.
Wow.
Yeah. And I got to tell you that the very next fucking day, I was kicking myself. I was just like, oh, my God, what was I thinking? I immediately called Chuck up. I called him back the next day. And, you know, it wasn't as easy to reach people back then, man.
Oh, right,
you know?
Exactly.
No one had cell phones. There was no internet.
Right.
You know, you didn't hop on the Facebooks and, you know, hit someone up with a PM, you know what I mean? So I was very lucky to catch him at home. And he was immediately, I was just, like, so deflated because I was just like, I was like, dude, I don't know what the hell I was thinking yesterday. I'm so sorry, man. You know, I mean, it was just loyalty to these guys because they've been good to me. But even they were, when I told them what was up and I told them what I said, they even told me I was stupid. And I knew it already. You know, I was like, dude, I love Death. You know, I love Death. Because we had already met. We had spoken before. You know, we had met at a Death concert, and he already knew. He knew me from, you know, from the fact that I toured with Agent Steel because he spotted me. I tell this story a little bit in my liner notes on the new reissue, remaster, deluxe reissue of Spiritual Healing that's just come out on Relapse. Yeah. So I sort of tell the story. I was just going to a show in Tampa that was in support of Leprosy, and I was wearing an Agent of Steel shirt from the tour that I did, and I was just headed to the door, man. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't, and all of a sudden I hear someone go, cool shirt, dude, you know, and I was like, kind of almost surfer guy type voice, you know, like California, you know, laid back, you know. And I looked over to see who said it. It was Chuck. And I was like, holy shit, that's Chuck Schuldiner, you know. And, you know, we got in a conversation, and I said, yeah, well, actually, you know, I earned this shirt touring with Agent Steel. Turned out he was an Agent Steel fan. He, like you, he was a fan of Skeptics Apocalypse and Avacus Rising. And I think Unstoppable Force, too. He liked that one as well. So, you know, we got in a conversation, and he came to know me as, like, okay, well, this guy's a guitar player. He's obviously pretty good if he toured with Agent Steel. So by the end of the night, you know, we had talked so much, he asked for my number. I gave him my mom's number because I didn't have a steady number, you know. And, you know, there were no cell phones like we just mentioned. So
right.
He gave my mom's number. So luckily it was my mom's number I gave him because she still lived in the same place, even though I had moved to Atlanta. So he was able to reach her, who gave her my number in Atlanta. And that's how it happened. But I called Chuck back, like I said, the next day after turning him down out of this weird sense of loyalty that, you know, even those guys that I was feeling loyalty to thought was ridiculous, you know, and told me so, no uncertain terms. So like I said, I called him up the next day, and Chuck was like, dude, oh, man, you know, I hear you, dude, but, you know, we didn't wait around. We had another guy in the wings, man, this guy Mark, and, you know, we've already told him he's in the band.
Wow.
And I was just like, oh, man. I was just like, well, dude, look, man, if he doesn't work out, just call me immediately. I won't hesitate to pack my pack my shit and move back to Florida. And I said, and you know what, dude? I already have the time off coming up a couple of days. It's only an 8-hour drive down there. If you guys have some time over the weekend, I'll drive down. I want to see my family anyway. I didn't need to see my family, but I just threw that in. I was like, I'd like to see my family anyway, so how about I come down? I just meet up with you guys just for a hang.
Right.
My guitar and a little, you know, I mean, there were no pods back then, but there were Rocktrons, you know, Tom Scholz Rockmans. So I'll bring down my little Tom Scholz Rockman, and if I got this boombox where I can plug in and play along at the same time with the tape, you know, and I'll show you what I could do with your songs, you know. And we can just hang, you know, and talk about records, you know, and everything. And we're like, okay, cool. Well, we're going to Terry Butler's house, you know,
right,
on this day at this time. So if you show up, we'll hang out. And it was really just a hangout. But I showed up with my boombox and my Tom Scholz Rockman and my guitar. And I went in and I was like, okay, dudes, here, check it out. And I threw it in and I played along to several songs on Leprosy and Scream Bloody Gore. But when it came time to the solos, I made up my own solos. I just improvised my own solos so that they could see what I could do solo-wise. It was weird because here I was soloing and then, the whammy bar solo, that Rick's solo, which, you know, dude, Rick's solos are classic. You know what I mean? It's just not my style. It's not what I do. I couldn't play like that if I wanted to, really. You know, that's Rick's style, not mine. So it was weird having me playing over Rick's style, you know. I wouldn't want to change those albums if I could. You know, if anyone started talking, even if Rick started talking about he wanted to go back and redo those solos, I'd be begging him not to. No, they're fucking classic. But, you know, it was a weird thing, you know, but they were able to tell, you know, that I could play the songs. And they were, you know, I could tell that they were sort of like, they were impressed, you know, how well I could actually play the tunes and, you know, what I was coming up with on my own solo-wise. They were impressed with that. But, you know, they were committed to this guy Mark, and that was clear as well. But all the same, we had a cool hang. We had a fun time. After that was over, we stopped talking about it, started talking about records and bands and everything like that, and just had a hangout. And then I said my goodbyes at the end of the night and drove back to my mom's house, and the next day I headed back to Atlanta, man. And I was crestfallen, and I felt like I had let myself down. I felt like I had just really, like, you know, I held on to that little nugget. Well, you know, I was just being loyal to guys who were good to me. Even though they think I was stupid to do it, still, I can hold on to that, you know. But I had sort of resigned myself. Fuck, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. I had an opportunity to play in one of my favorite fucking bands, you know. I blew it. But as it turned out, Mark didn't ultimately work out. I think, I really don't know what the issues were, but he didn't ultimately work out. And I think it only took him about a week to figure that out from that point. And so Chuck called me the very next week and said, hey, dude, well, check it out. Good news. Mark didn't work out. So if you're still down, the position is yours. You've basically already auditioned.
Awesome.
And I was like, I'm already packing while I'm on the phone with you. And and this isn't even a wireless handset. I'm fucking stretching that cord. I'm packing. You know, I took off the next day. The guy, you know, all my Atlanta buds, you know, the Hollows Eve guys and all of our friends, like including like the guys from Nihilist, U.S. Nihilist, the Georgia Nihilist, who had a really popular demo in the scene back then. Like, people thought they were going to get signed, and they were like literally, everyone said they were going to be the next band to get signed. And those guys are still kicking around playing a kind of a southern rock band called Blackberry Smoke, I think. But anyway, they all threw me a party, you know. They had a little send-off for me, and I hit the road and joined Death, and that's how that happens.
You listen to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, James Murphy. Coming up, we talk life and death. But first, this is Jerry Pump.
This is Mem from Exhumer, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Keep it locked, the Thrash Dial.
Awesome.
This is Tony Patel from Whiplash, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hi, this is Nige Rocket from Onslaught, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. This is Steve Gattosuzza from Hatriot, and probably a bunch of other million brass bands that you've heard of in the past. Anyway, you are listening to Third Eye Cinema with the G-Man, so turn it up and start a pit in your living room.
Awesome.
So, coming up, we talk life and death. But first, just to show you what we're talking about, here's one off his effective debut with the legendary Death. This is Spiritual Healing. Then you moved on to join Chuck Sheldon, what was to become the first of the Death albums to move in a more progressive, less straightforward death metal-oriented direction, which is Spiritual Healing. Now, my feeling was that Chuck tended to hire some really good and technically-oriented musicians for the band over the years, of which you're probably the first that really stood out in that respect. But I'm going to say something that I know is a bit controversial among fans, was that personally, I felt that all these folks, you know, the initial Camley Rick Ross lineup, Chris Reifert, and then the technical crowd like you and the guys from Cynic and Andy LaRoque, Steve DiGiorgio, Rash Santola, had either done already or go on to do what I think was much better work elsewhere. You know, it feels to me like Chuck already kind of had his mind made up and was just kind of pull people in like chess pieces to ornament his material. Because what I was hearing on Spiritual Healing, which you already said is probably wrong, is that while you do get to lay down your trademark solos for what I think you said was the first time on a record, they almost seem to get buried by the structure of the songs themselves, which at this point in the band's history is beginning to become more cluttered and complicated by comparison with the first two albums and the demos. So did you find yourself feeling stifled at all by the constraints of the band and Chuck's material? Or, you know, how much of the album did you bring to the plate?
Not at all. I actually wrote 25% of the music. I wrote one quarter of the riffs on that album. I had a lot to do with the structure. Four of the songs were written before I came in. The other four I co-wrote with Chuck and Terry. Of course, Bill, you know, came up with his drum beats and
right.
helped with the arrangements and all that sort of thing. So we all contributed. I was very heavily contributed. I didn't feel cloistered or constricted or held back in any way. In fact, that was really one of my most pleasant surprises coming into the band was when I showed up at that first writing session / rehearsal for the band. You know, when I joined the band, it was only a few weeks to go before entering the studio for the album, and four songs still needed to be written. I came in, and within the first few minutes of jamming, like, we jammed a couple of, they taught me the four that were already written,
And then we immediately started working on a fifth one that Chuck already had a few riffs for. And he was like, yeah, so I got this riff and I got this riff. What do you got anything that maybe goes there? And I immediately started pulling out riffs. And I was like, well, I got this thing that sounds like it might fit with that. And I played it. And I was expecting, like, I was fully expecting and prepared for what else you got?
Right.
You know, and then for Chuck to ultimately come up with all the riffs. That was what I was envisioning in my mind happening. Like, I was not expecting acceptance of my riffs. But what happened was the opposite. From the very first riff that I showed him, every single riff that I showed him, he right. liked it immediately, and it either fit right at the spot we were working at, or he had it, oh, you know what, maybe that doesn't fit there, but I got this other riff that it'll fit with, and then he immediately just was putting stuff together. I mean, he was even coming up with places to fit things that I was playing that weren't even intended to be part of songs. And
wow.
for instance, the intro to Killing Spree. It goes, that's me playing that legato riff and Chuck doing the chords underneath. And the way that riff happened was we took a break. And a lot of times what we would do when we took a break, I mean, me and Chuck both, we loved to play. So, you know, we were kids, still just had the hunger to play. So even though we stopped and we opened up the doors to get some air in, it was roll storage spots where we rehearsed in Altamont Springs, Florida, which, you know, in summertime, in August, which was hot as hell. We'd roll that door open, and we'd have to turn our amps way down once that door was open, but we'd still be noodling while we were taking our little break and while we were chit-chatting. And, you know, these days, bands take a little break, and they all are sitting there ignoring each other, going through their phones or their laptops, texting
right.
other people, talking on, you know, Skyping their girlfriend, doing whatever, you know.
True.
Back then, we had nothing to do but talk to each other. You know what I mean? And it was a really good thing. I think it helped build camaraderie, you know, and it helped us come up with things like this. Like I said, for instance, he accepted everything, even things that weren't intended. Because I was sitting there doing a finger exercise, legato finger exercise. And granted, I turned it around a lot quicker than I normally would, and I started doing it in this really limited way, up and down like that. And Chuck's here after a minute or two, and he was like, what's that you're playing? And I said, finger exercise. He was like, keep doing it. And he turns his guitar up a little bit, matches volume with me, and starts doing chords underneath it. And immediately, we have the intro to Killing Spree. And that's how it happened. And I have to say that I strongly disagree with you about the progressivity of spiritual healing. I don't think it exists so much. I think spiritual healing is a solid metal record. I think it's just a catchy, solid metal record. I think it certainly refined Death style from what was on. It was definitely a refinement. It was a very natural progression from Scream to Leprosy to Spiritual. It refined it, but it's just pure metal. I don't think there's very much progressive about it at all. And I think, much like you originally said, the solos really gave me a chance to really do something really musically. So the solo sections that we wrote, four of the songs, I had the opportunity to write my own riff that I played over, in addition to many other riffs in the songs. So I did not feel constrained in any way. I don't feel that the album was so progressive that it hindered me musically. I think it's a masterpiece of catchy, very well refined, but
right.
not very progressive at all. Death metal. I think you really started getting progressive on Human. Probably the weirdest time signature on Spiritual Healing is that there might be a 6/8, maybe a 3/4, which is tend to kind of avoid because unless you write the riff just right, it's like a waltz. You know?
Right.
But you know, maybe there's a measure or two of 3/4 here and there, but it's basically just four on the floor, you know, death metal with well-structured, very metal, not very progressive, but very metal, very catchy, very well-refined riffs.
So you've tapped into this a little already, but what was it actually like working with Chuck? Because he had this reputation for chewing musicians up and spitting them out, but most folks recall him as being a laid-back, friendly sort on a personal level.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Chuck on a business level and Chuck on a personal level is two different things, much like anybody, you know what I mean? But the real key thing here is that me and Chuck got along fantastically the whole time I was in the band. For the writing sessions, I mean, everything, it was great. We all got along famously. I mean, we had good times. And we genuinely hung together as pals and just watched movies together, cracked up, went and ate hot wings together, just had a good old time, you know what I mean? Problems started happening on tour. I mean, it's no secret that me and Chuck had problems. No secret that Chuck had problems with lots of members over the years. I just don't think that over 20 years later that there's anything more to say about it than we were kids.
Right. That's true.
We were kids that were getting a lot of attention in our little clique, and that feeds egos of kids who are getting their names out there in, you know, in the world, and are quite possibly alpha males to boot. Both right. alpha males. You got 2, 3, 4 alpha males together when you're young, dumb, you know. Well, there's really nothing more to say about it than that. We were kids. And, you know, after my split with Death, me and Chuck didn't talk together for, I would say, 8, 9 years.
Yeah. Ouch.
Yeah, but eventually we did. And when we did, it was water under the bridge. Because, you know, at some point you realize, wait a minute, I'm a grown-up now.
Right, exactly. And, you know, like I was telling, I actually talked to Rick the other night, and I was like, you know, I'm not trying to start shit here. I'm just trying to get to the bottom of, okay, what really happened here? This is what I saw as a fan and from the media and whatever else. What really happened?
Yeah, I mean, there's really nothing deep to it, you know? I mean, the only way to get deeper is if you find someone who's going to be willing to discuss their petty differences that they had 20 years ago. Anyone that you could find that would talk about that stuff and, like, be serious, like, seriously want to tell you about it, seriously want to dredge it, silly stuff like that up, would probably not be worth talking to. At the end of the day, this stuff was over 20 years ago. We all kissed and made up since then. It really just sort of came down to the fact that we were all kids, and we were, you know, we all thought we were the rooster.
Closing the book on this whole section, you were there for the album and its related tour, but that was it for your tenure with Death, so... Did Evil Chuck strike again and fire everyone after the Spiritual Healing Tour, or did you decide it wasn't the right situation for you to express your talents at that point?
No, actually, I left before Terry and Bill did. You know, they left before, you know, the Human album, but they actually stayed in and I think did 2 more tours for Spiritual than I did, one with Chuck and one without. You know, one in the States with Chuck and one in Europe without. And they were also in the early writing sessions, I think, for Human, in the very earliest writing stages. Now, how much of whatever they worked on during those sessions remained and ended up on Human, I do not know, either from Chuck or from Terry or Bill. I could not tell you. You would have to ask Terry that. The only one accessible, obviously, because Bill lives in Japan. But, and no one knows. I don't know anyone who knows how to reach him. Maybe Terry does. But, you know, they left, you know, months after me. And right. What happened with me was, you know, just I started seeing there started to be pressure at the seams, and, you know, started to see, you know, sort of unravel the stitching a little bit of our
right.
sort of what had been a really tight-knit group of friends. And it was just sort of down to that whole thing. We were young. We were all headstrong. You know, while we got along personably, you know, we didn't necessarily agree about everything under the sun.
Right.
And, you know, we didn't all necessarily behave in the most adult fashion.
Well, what do you want? You're all like 20.
Yeah, we were in our very early 20s, and we were, you know, we were just kids. So, you know, I mean, it is what it is. There's literally 22 years later, no blame to be laid anywhere except to youth and inexperience. So, you know, it just sort of coming apart on tour. We eventually grated on each other's nerves, and I started seeing the writing on the wall that things might not go great for me to stay in the band, so I started planning to leave. You know, I started feeling like on the last day of the tour that I was going to get let go and that I wasn't going to be allowed to retrieve a lot of my gear. And, of course, you know, wanting to continue as a professional guitarist, I desperately needed that gear. So I decided to pack my stuff, get it ready, pile it into a taxi, and take off. Not the most professional thing in the world, but I was a kid. They actually had anticipated my move, or they were already planning on firing me before the end of the tour, which is what I think was actually the case. It was a weird thing. We were a couple of dates away from the end of that first tour, and we had been on the road together for a solid month, and I was planning to split, and they were planning to ditch me, and it came to fruition on the same night. I don't think that they knew I was planning to split. I didn't know for sure that they were planning to ditch me. We both suspected it, but neither of us suspected we were going to do it on the same night. And we sort of, they came to me to tell me that they were sending me home, and they found me packing my shit. You know, and it was sort of, we were both looking at each other like, ruh-roh, you know? So we struck a compromise whereby I took part of my gear, but not all of it. Right. I was allowed to take my amp head, and I think my outboard gear, my, you know, my effects and whatnot, and my cables and all that sort of stuff. But they kept my cabinets and my guitars. I don't hey, man, no big deal. I don't hold it against him. Water under the bridge, I don't care. I wouldn't have still had those guitars to this day anyway. I would have gotten rid of them. I would have traded them for something stupid. I traded guitars a lot back then. So I ended up heading home with part of my gear, not all of it.
Wow.
Now, having said that, it made it sort of sound like that, you know, just so that it's clear that I'm not trying to make them sound shitty for keeping the gear, understand this, Chuck was extremely fair to me. He paid me very fairly. He paid me more than fairly. I would go so far as to say Chuck was outright generous. So I did not go home broke. We did very well on that tour in terms of guarantees, bonuses, merchandise sales. We did very well, and we split everything equally. That, I felt, to share equally with me when I had just only done one album with him, and I thought was incredibly generous of him. And he kept that up to the last day, even when he knew he was going to fire me. That's very impressive. I admire that to this day. And frankly, I've never encountered that level of integrity
with anybody else.
Yeah. Ever again in this business. Ever again.
That says a lot.
Yeah. It absolutely does. So I think it's sort of pointless. I mean, I get what you were going for, but I have to say that I just sort of think it's pointless to go for that. And I don't think you're going to get anybody to talk about it because, first of all, who really remembers every little stupid
right.
22 years later, you know? What I really remember is the good times, great shows. Now, were there really bad moments that stood out and were maybe, you know, scarring at the time a little bit? Sure. But to even talk about them so many years later, when it was already one other bitch, we were already passed it up. And most importantly, when one of the key parties involved can no longer even speak up and offer their side of this, is not only just pointless, but it would be mean-spirited, petty, unprofessional, and childish. I had great times. I had great times in this. Chuck was very, very fair to me. And that's really the crux of it, you know? We had problems, just like everybody has problems. There are no juicy tidbits. If you actually knew all the little details of everything that would happen, you would be just like, oh, so these guys are just dumb fucks like everybody else. They argue over dumb shit like everybody in the world. Yeah, we were human.
There you go.
You know?
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with a special guest tonight, James Murphy. Coming up next, we'll talk the cause of death and obituary. Here on Third Eye Cinema.
Hey, this is Kara from Mortillery, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Rock the fuck out. I don't know. Do you want me to do it again? Hey, it's Kara. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Okay, I'll do it again. Just play, like, all the retakes so people can laugh at it. Hey, this is Kara from Mortillery, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hi, everyone. This is Nolan from Kryptos. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Was that good? Hi, everyone. This is Nolan Lewis from Kryptos, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hi, guys. This is Rohit here from Kryptos, and you're listening to Third Eye. Okay, I'll say that again. Okay. Hi, this is Rohit from Kryptos, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Yeah. Melon.
Melon.
Yeah, and all that cheeky stuff.
Okay. Hello, this is Trollman from Trollfest, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Keep it real, people.
And next up, we talk cause of death. And appropriately enough, this is James and one of the true linchpin albums of the Florida death metal scene. This is Obituary with the title track.
Mm-hmm.
You moved on fairly quickly to what, for most fans of the genre, cite as your magnum opus and one of the greatest, if not the greatest, records in death metal history, which is Cause of Death. And to this day, when I think of James Murphy, Obituary, Scott Burns and Morrison, or death metal in general, Cause of Death is like the first or one of the first albums that comes to mind. And yet I understand the whole thing was pretty much written already when they temporarily fired Alan West. So did you have any input into the material, or was it just
another... Well, they didn't fire Alan West, just to be clear. That was not my understanding. Alan bowed out, decided he didn't want to do it anymore. I don't know why. And to that point, let me tell you that, just understand, what I did was, when I was headed home, I was at the bus stop. You know, I got on the payphone, remember those? And I got as many quarters as I could, and I pumped them into that payphone, and I called Scott Burns at Morrisound. I had no idea what he was doing, who was in the studio with what, but... You know, I had made friends with Scott, and I wanted to tell him what had happened. He was one of the few people that I wanted to know what had happened. And I was just like, yeah, Scott, so I'm coming home. I'm not going to be in Depth anymore. I'm out. So I'm going to be looking for a gig. So keep an eye and an ear out for me, buddy. And he goes, well, I might be able to accommodate that quicker than you think. I happen to be in the studio with Obituary right now, and Alan West has left the band, and they need a lead guitar player. We've already got the drums and most of the rhythm guitars in the can, so we're going to be here still for X amount of more days, so we need to get bass, vocals, and lead guitars done in those time. Let me talk to the guys. Call me back when you get to the next payphone. So I called him back when I got to the next payphone, and he said, dude, they want to meet with you as soon as you get here. So literally, I came home from the Death Tour. Next day, I was at Morrisound meeting with Obituary and Scott Burns. And on that first meeting... They told me that I had the position. They already heard my playing. They'd already seen me playing with Death. They knew that I could do, so they knew they wanted me to have me for the spot. But to their credit, they made no bones to me about the fact that Alan was their longtime bro. They had basically grown up with him, and they told me in very clear terms that if he ever decided he wanted to come back, that they would probably take him. And ultimately, that's what happened.
So. Yeah. Did you have any input into the material, or was it just another studio musician?
No. The material was done. My writing style very much suited Death at the time, and I was sort of trying to go a little heavier and a little bit more technical, which ended up in Disincarnate type material. So my writing style was nothing like Obituary's. My writing style was very much like, at the time, somewhere between what you heard on Spiritual Healing and what you eventually heard on Disincarnate.
Some of the solo sections, you know, where the rhythm slows down to this funereal halftime while you're throwing down one of your leads, reminded me of, like, the solo section, say, of Within the Mind from Spiritual Healing. So I could see you bringing that kind of thing with you.
That was just probably pure coincidence.
So what was it like working with the Tardies? You know, was it true that John didn't bother writing actual lyrics in those days, but just kind of said little nonsense phrases?
Yeah. That's not a secret. That's something that, you know, John himself let out of the bag many years ago. just sort of made things up. And, I mean, the few lyrics that you see written on, you know, in the liner notes of Cause of Death, a few little lines here and there, are an amalgamation of all the lines throughout the album that Chuck, where he actually did say something.
Right.
And I would say a good portion of those lines are where he really didn't say nothing, but it sounded like that to one or more of us, you know? Like, a couple of those lines are just where John was just pure vocalizing, no words. But I said, hey, it sounds like this. And it said, okay, well, write that down, you know?
Wow.
You know? And so it became a lyric in that little paragraph of the very few words on there just by default, because it sort of sounded like he said that. Well, you didn't really. Yeah, he never made any bones about that.
Because even back then, I saw him like, is this the entire lyric sheet? Because it sounds like everything
yeah,
he said.
It actually was, yeah. In Obituary in the early days, there was a whole lot of rotting in the waste below going on, I'll tell you that. And I loved it. It was, you know, John's awesome. John's an incredible singer. I hate to keep leaning on that word because it's so overused, but he truly is a legend of the genre, and it was awesome. It was good times. And, you know, I had a lot of good times in Obituary. I will say this, that those guys were not as experienced business-wise as Chuck, and they were not as fair with me as Chuck. Again, years later, I don't hold it against them personally at all. We get along great, buddies with them all. We get along excellent. Not an issue. But back then, it really bothered me that they weren't as fair with me as Chuck was. But I was a kid. I was not good at communicating. I was used to business being handled a certain way. It wasn't handled that way in Obituary, primarily because of probably their inexperience at the time. And I didn't handle it well because of my just sort of lack of skill. I didn't have great communication skills back then. I didn't really know how to communicate if I was unhappy about something well. I didn't understand how to articulate my business thoughts well. So I internalized a lot of that stuff. It ended up coming out, you know, it ended up sort of boiling over and coming out. It made me tense. And again, you know, I was a rooster back then, you know. I was like, rah, you know. And I wasn't good at communicating my feelings about those sort of things. And so it all just sort of internalized and bubbled over, and it undoubtedly made those guys are very laid back. John and Don both very
right.
laid back guys, you know, like to kick back, smoke a dude, and you know, chill. And I did not smoke out back, you know, I did not smoke out. I didn't participate in that,
right.
And so I was, you know, I was just getting aggravated that I, you know, things weren't going the way they did in death on the business side. It made me actually have a very tense time in the band sometimes. Not all the time, but sometimes. And,
yeah.
you know, I wasn't a happy camper a lot. So essentially, as soon as, you know, and I did three really long tours with Obituary. First one in the States with Sacred Reich and Fourth Century. Then I went to Europe with Demolition Hammer and Morgoth. And then came back into this North America again with Sepultura and Sadus. We headlined two of them. We were in the middle on the Sepultura headline. And so we did these three really long tours with those guys. And by the time it's time to perhaps start writing for a further Obituary record, I was already well into writing Disincarnate type material. Trevor had already asked me to show him some of my riffs, and I was like, well, you know, I don't really think they sound like Obituary, but here you go. And he was like, yeah, they don't really sound like Obituary. And I said, yeah, I'll probably use them for a project if I'm going to be staying in the band. It's my own side project thing. By then, Trevor already had his own side project thing going with Mitch from Napalm Death and Beat Hook Seed. So doing projects was not a thing that was, you know, it was on the table. So I thought, yeah, I'll do a project. I'll do, you know, Disincarnate. But, you know, I always had this thing, if I stay in the band, because who knows what's going to happen.
Right.
And ultimately, Alan West did decide to return. And
right.
they were all like, well, good. James is a tense dude. You know, I don't think they understood why I was tense. I was tense probably because I just was tense back then because I wasn't as experienced in, you know, in group dynamics back then as I am these days. And I was younger and I was alpha male, you know, thought I was the, you know, the alpha dog. And I was really not happy with business side of things and extremely deficient in my communication skills in terms of articulating that to them. So I'm much better at communication these days.
Right. So just closing up on this, I also think that the album may have been the first time I encountered the studio trickery of drum triggers. So was Donald really playing all that sort of incessant typewriter-style footwork, or was it more reliant on Scott King in loops at the mixing desk?
Donald absolutely can play every little bit of that. And what you got to understand about the way drum sampling was done back then, it was not done like it is today, where you just sort of key and drop loops, you know, use the looper tool in Pro Tools or
right, exactly.
something like that. It was not done that way. I mean, that album was still recorded on 2-inch tape, you know. And what you got to understand, too, is Spiritual Healing was recorded several months prior. Yeah, I think we were recording Cause of Death in March of 1990. And, you know, we started recording Spiritual Healing in August of 89. No, September of 89. So it was 6 months later. So there were drum triggers on, I mean, there were samples. You understand, a lot of people conflate the terms triggers and samples. Triggers are actually one thing, samples are another. Triggers are what are used to trigger samples, since their name. But triggers themselves are just a mechanical device that don't make any more noise than a little click. But that little click can then in turn trigger a sample in a drum module that has inputs with, you know, thresholds set to recognize that little click and cause it to fire a sample off. So while I don't think that there were necessarily actually triggers on the drums themselves, the drums were used, the audio of the drums was used to trigger a sample. I think the way it was done was, if I recall correctly, at the time, there was an old device made by TC Electronic called a 2290, and it had a little bit of sample memory, and you could use the audio of the original drums to trigger a sample from a sampler, one of the big old Akai's or something. Or no, you would just load that sample, you would just record that sample into the memory of the 2290. You would just drop that sample into the memory of the 2290 and trigger from that, you know, using the audio of the kick drum, and then just record that and then sort of get it lined up. I think it was done that way. I'm not positive, you know, memory's hazy 22 years later, but you get the picture. Like, it wasn't as easy as drum loops are these days. So yeah, there are samples on both those albums, Spiritual Healing and 6 months later, Cause of Death. But yes, both drummers actually played everything and could do it with ease.
So when you were recording this record, did you have any idea that it would instantly become a genre-defining classic? Because to this day, it's often one of the first albums people mention when you say the words death metal.
Man, I got to say this. I'm going to give you that old nugget that you always get from everybody. Oh, you know, we had no idea. You know, we knew it was cool. We had no idea it was going to be a big... And, you know, truly and realistically, in real terms, I didn't have any real idea. I didn't have any concrete idea. I certainly didn't know it was going to be. But, man, I was so enthusiastic for music back then and so enthusiastic for every project that I was on that, dude, everything that I was a part of, I was just sure was going to be awesome and was going to do great. Right. Not because I thought I was awesome or I thought it was so great, but I was just enthusiastic for the music. I thought, I love these tunes. There's no way everyone else isn't going to love them. You know what I mean? I'm still like that to this day. Even as a producer, I'll work with a band, and I just love their music. And I'm like, man, this album is going to do well for these guys. And then it comes out, and, you know, nothing. You know?
Right. Well, it's different. There's so many albums out, and there's so many bands. It's not like it was back then.
Yeah, true. But, you know what? There was a lot of that going on back then, too. But, I was very fortunate to do a number, my first several albums in a row that became, you know, sort of classics of the genre.
And, you know, there's a particular atmosphere to that record, which a lot of the truly great death metal albums had, that was quite unique and unexpected. You know, there was nothing that sounded or felt like that same feel at the time. If you want to name the critical records of the genre, you get Entombed's Left Hand Path, Deicide's
Absolutely.
View, and Cause of Death. You know, everything else is kind of, I hate to say sloppy seconds, but, you know, from there on out, it gets lesser. So where did all this come from? You know, how much of this was just, you know, what the band was bringing? How much of it was your input? How much was what Scott brought?
I don't know, man. I don't think you can leave out Scream, Bloody Gore, and Leprosy. So, Scott didn't do any songwriting. I think he may have made some arrangement suggestions here and there, if I recall correctly, which, you know, any good producer will do if such changes are called for. But, like, he might call to our attention, like, hey, guys, is there going to be a vocal or a solo here? No? Well, then possibly drags on a little too long. Maybe you want to cut it in half. Do it two bars less, you know, or something like that, you know, advice which we probably took. So he definitely had an influence in that regard. He certainly helped us, you know, in dialing in our tones. I wouldn't say that he shaped the tone. He polished what our tone was. Like, we were saying, hey, here's our tone. Like, okay, cool. This is what you're going for. All right. I can make that. I can shape that and make it a little better. I can take what you want and make it awesome on record. You know, that's what he did. So I would say he had that influence in shaping it. We showed up. I mean, back then, what do you understand? Working as a producer myself these days, very few bands these days show up to record with the level of preparedness that we used to show up to record records back then. I mean, bands hardly get together. The amount of times we used to jam together in a physical room together before we would go in to record a record back then was orders of magnitude more than the average band does so now. And I think the internet has had a lot to do with that. They think they can pass some files back and forth from each other, and, you know, that sort of substitutes for getting in a room and jam together.
And it doesn't.
It really does not. And so we used to show up prepared. I mean, we had our thing together. Our song sounded like our song sounded for the most part when we showed up at the studio. The drummer was tight. We were tight. We had our shit down. And, you know, some bands do that still these days, but it's far more rare than it was back then, I think. And, you know, it was a matter of necessity. I think if we would have access to the internet and things like, you know, Guitar Pro and, you know, things like that people...
You probably would have used them. Yeah, sure.
We would have used them, and we wouldn't have necessarily been as prepared as we were. We had no choice but to get together and jam, and, you know, we didn't have all the distractions. We were stuck there together in that room together. There were no cell phones ringing. There was no, you know, Skype calls chiming in. There were no text messages dinging, and we had to sit there and do it. And, you know, if you took a break, you were probably noodling on your guitar because there was no Words with Friends notification waiting for you. So, you know, it was a benefit that we had. And I'm not, you know, trying to say that the good old days were better. You know, I love all the modern conveniences, man. I use them all, you know. And I certainly help bands that I work with to employ them to their benefit. But, you know, just sort of get to the point of your question, you know, how much did the producer shape what we came up with? I would say it was important. But in a minimalistic way, it wasn't massively carving what we had. It was refining and tuning what we came in pretty damn well prepared to throw down. But having said that, I don't mean to say that in any way to minimalize that role of Scott or any other producer that did that job at that time, because it was fucking important, really important.
This is Brian Lawrence from Dream Death, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Okay. Here are you.
Hi, this is Mirai from Psy, and you are listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hi, this is Dr. McCannibal from Psy. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
And in our final segment, we'll be talking James Stint with British Standby's Cancer. And first up, here's James and the band off the Death Shall Rise album. This is Hung, Drawn, and Quartered. So from here, you head over to Join Britain's Cancer, who, like Obituary, put out one decent...
But, well, I'll stop you there. I never joined a Cancer. I wasn't a member of Cancer. Here's the thing. I was supposed to be listed as a guest member of that album. That photo shoot that has a picture of me on that album, that was supposed to be press for the tour because I was going to go on the tour.
Wow.
I showed up with them. Every single one of those photos from that photo shoot was also done in a version without me in it. So that they would have the option to pick from those for their album.
Wow.
And ones with me for tour. Because when we took the pictures, we didn't know which ones were going to end up on the album sleeve in terms of, you know, locations and poses. You know, the way the members were arranged in the picture. We did not know that. So
right.
They knew that the label, they were going to use this photo shoot both for the album and for promotion for the tour. You're going to be on the tour, so we want to use you as a promo. So they basically told me. And I wouldn't say it was so much the band members that lied, but their label that did, Vinyl Solution, just told a big, fat story. So, yeah, all those photos, there's versions of those without me in them. Those without me in them were supposed to be on the album sleeve. I was supposed to be listed as a guest guitarist. And then on the tour, I was supposed to be in the picture because I was going to be on the tour, listed as guest touring musician. They
right.
did not do that any step of the way. And, you know, I did multiple interviews during the time of that tour where I was asked about why I joined the band. And I'd point out, well, I haven't really. I have my own band that I'm working on, Disincarnate, which is what I was doing, already writing Disincarnate. I was already in talks with Roadrunner. I was talking with Roadrunner about, you know, whether I should do this Cancer stuff. I think at the time that I was told, you know, hey, yeah, sure, you do the album, it'll be cool. Maybe it'll good extra press for, you know, a good boost for the Disincarnate record, you know. I had already left Obituary. I had already started demoing with a cheap little drum machine and a boombox, and I had already gotten Roadrunner interested. I hadn't signed a deal yet, but they were interested. They wanted first dibs. I think we did a demo deal and a little right of first refusal contract. I was doing the Cancer stuff strictly as a guest. I actually initially did it, came in and threw down a solo. It was meant to be one solo, and
right.
I had no idea who Cancer was, no idea at all, had never
right.
heard of them, basically met them and agreed to do the solo all as part of doing a favor for Scott. Because here's the thing. By that time, I lived a short little 10-minute drive away. I was working at Aces Records in Tampa. I lived a few minutes from Aces and only about 10 to 15 minutes from Morrisound, depending on traffic. Now, Morrisound was certainly well-stocked with amplifiers. But unlike the project studios that are much more prevalent today to have metal albums done in, big studios, you know, big commercial studios like Morrisound, while they had a huge selection of amps, if you wanted to use them, that was an a la carte item. You had to pay a rental fee on top of your
wow.
studio. So as I had already mentioned, a lot of these bands, like Cancer and like Atrocity, were working on very limited budgets with very limited time. They came over from overseas. They didn't have cabinets there, and it was going to cost them to use the cabinets that belonged to Morris Sound. Scotty knew that I lived just down the road and that I had perfectly good cabinets, you know, partial cabs and whatnot, because I had brought them in, you know, from my recordings there. And so he would call me from time to time, as he did with Cancer, as he did with Atrocity and a few other bands, and asked if it was cool if he borrowed my cabinet or borrowed a head or borrowed this, that, or the other. And I always accommodated him, and I'd bring it down. I had a little hatchback car, and I'd bring it down.
Right.
And so my cabinet is on probably more albums out of Morris Sound than I am, you know, my speaker cabinet. But the Cancer guys had also asked Scotty, well, do you think he could ask him to do a guest solo, you know, because the soloist was John, just like he was on their first album, you know, the singer. You know, he was the guitar player, and he was also the lead guitar player. So I came in, I did my one guest solo, I loaned him my cabinet, and I took off. I got a call from Scott the next day saying, hey, you know, the guys were talking about it, and they're just not really happy. John started laying down his solos, and the other guys weren't really happy with his solos, and they were really felt like with your solo there, John's is really sounding kind of hurting. He wasn't really prepared to lay any down, and even John is agreeing with them. You know, I mean, I never even heard them, so I could not make the call on that. It's like, well, what are they proposing? So, well, you know, they want to pay you probably a couple $100 at the time to play the rest of the solos on the album and appear on the album as a special guest. And I was like, well, you know, it was fun doing the one solo I already did. Right. They were really cool dudes. Hey, I could use a couple $100. And so I went down and did it. I think I recorded all those solos in one day, you know, one afternoon and evening in the studio. And again, went home. Then they asked me to tour. We have a tour coming up, short little tour. And I didn't bite on it right away. I was like, I don't know. You know, I've got a job. I got my own album that I'm working on. I've got a development deal right now with demo/development deal with Roadrunner, finishing writing the tunes. I'm looking for members. And, you know, I got an apartment that I got to keep up, and I got a girlfriend that I got to maintain that lives with me at the apartment, no less. And so, you know, I don't know if I can – I've been with this girl since I was in Death, so I've had to leave her so much, you know, from going on tour with Death, you know, going to the studio with Death, going on tour with Obituary, going to the studio with Obituary, leaving her alone. You know, she's – for me to this quick after all that to go out with you guys, I mean, I just don't know. So they accepted that, but then they got back with me again the next day. We want to up the offer. We will pay – for an extra ticket, if you'll come do this European and UK tour with us to support the album, we'll pay an extra. And this is while they were still recording their tracks on the Cancer album that I want. We'll buy a ticket for your girlfriend. She can come over too. And she can hang out with our girlfriends. Right. Our girlfriends are going to come to about half the shows. They're going to come to all the UK shows and possibly come over to France and, you know, Germany and whatnot too. You know, they can take the ferry from Dover to Calais. You know, your girls can hang with our girls. You know, they can have a good old time, and we'll buy you that ticket. And I was like, You know, I'm going to go ahead and tentatively say yes. Let me run it by my girlfriend. And just my girlfriend jumped the opportunity. So the next thing I know, I'm in Europe touring with Cancer. That I actually went back and did another one and didn't take my girlfriend. And that turned out to be a huge mistake, and, you know, on a number of levels. And I let Cancer know at the end of that, like, hey, man, been great hanging with you guys. I'm not going to be able to do any more tours for you. I'm actually, you know, as you know, I'm not a member of your band. Your label has already douched me and... You know, it looked like I'm a member of the band. I'm having to field all these questions about me being a member of your band while I'm, you know, and it's become just way too hairy. I need to go focus on my own band, my own record deal, and, you know, good luck. And, you know, we stayed friends, and they ended up actually even coming over and touring with Disincarnate when we did our first tour. But that's the story of that in a nutshell. I was never a member of that band, and it's just due to really kind of an unscrupulous label who wanted to try to capitalize on having former Death and Obituary guitarist James Murphy in their band. It was really made to look like that was the case. And, you know, again, there was no internet for me to pop onto to post a rebuttal on, you know, Blabbermouth, you know, back in those days, you know. So
during this period while you were working on Cause of Death and Death Shall Rise, you were doing a huge amount of session work where you come in and do a guest solo on one song of a band's album without really being involved with them in any way. So was this just something Scott liked to do, putting you and Glenn Benton and other folks' records here and there? Because Glenn showed up on Napalm's Death, Harmony Corruption, two Cannibal Corpse albums, and even joined you on the Cancer album doing background vocals on Comes Around a Quarter. But you were all over the place. I mean, I think the ones I remember most were your guest spots on Gorguts Considered Death and Malevolent Creation's Retribution. But you can tell that you didn't have a lot invested in the material. You know, the songs themselves didn't slow down to accommodate your leads like they did with the other bands.
Yeah, it wasn't so much that I needed the parts to slow down. The speed was never the issue. It was whether the part went somewhere. The tempo of it was irrelevant. It's all about the chord changes, irrespective of the tempo. But right. I really, I mean, any soloist can really let loose when there's changes, not just a repetitive riff. But to answer your question more specifically, this is the thing. This question always kind of takes me a little bit aback because despite the fact that I, up to that time, you know, before I joined Testament, I was known strictly for death metal stuff. So I was death metal guitarist James Murphy. Right. Really, I've always just been guitarist James Murphy, who loves death metal, who loves thrash, who loves classic old school heavy metal, you know, and would be happy playing in a band of any of those genres and writes material in all of those genres, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Thrash, speed metal, the whole nine. For me, every other genre of music, even including most other metal genres, it is longstanding traditions of guest musicians. And no one questions this. Just guest spot. You know, hey, we got a guest musician. We got a studio guy. We got a session guy. Both session work and guest work is extremely common in all other kind of music. But when it comes to death metal, people don't understand session work. Now, these days, guest stuff and session work is extremely common in every genre of metal, including death metal and everything else. But back then, it was an alien concept to people. You know, they would scratch their head like, why is this guy, quote unquote, and this was one I got a lot, whoring himself around? I'm not whoring myself around. I got a lot of friends that play a lot of music that I like, and they like my music, and we're fucking making music together. Right. No one's fucking making money off, you know, you know. While I occasionally got paid a token amount when labels would make me sign a release, they'd right. usually throw me a little token amount anywhere from 100 to 250 bucks to say, hey, you can't ever come back and sue us and say we owe you royalties on this. You just did a guest solo, man, and it's going to be okay, and your label says it's okay that you're doing it, and, you know, things like that. That's what it was. But they tend to think that it was something weird or odd or bizarre about it, and the way you framed your question exactly underscores that. But for me, because I was into all kinds of music, you know, the amount of time that I spent listening to death metal when I wasn't playing it, it was maybe 20% of my listening. The other 80% of what I listened to, people doing guest work and session work, was extremely common, accepted, normal process. Hey, man, this is what I say to people that scratch their head about that back then. I'm a musician. This is a thing that musicians do. Death metal seems to be the only genre where people don't understand that. But I understand why you asked the question. It's because people did think there was back then. I don't think it was ever Scott saying, let's throw James Murphy on this. It was always the band requesting, hey, you know James Murphy, right? Can you get him to play on her? It was always requested by the band. With one exception, I have never asked to play on someone's album. I was a huge Napalm Death fan, and I sort of hinted around at it to the Napalm Death guy. But, you know, they didn't bite, although, you know, we remained friends for years and years and years, but I don't think that they had the idea to have my type of soloing on their record. You know what I mean? They were, I think, while certainly Barney was a big fan of my type of guitar playing, dude, me and Barney were, you know, Mark, were pen pals for years. Used to write and exchange CDs across the pond, you know? Other than that, like, little hint that I threw out there and got denied unceremoniously, you know, by my good pals. I've never asked to be on an album, and I don't think Scott ever asked anyone to put me on their album.
And you're actually still doing this for bands, I've noticed, popping on and doing solos here and there.
Absolutely. Hey, man, I'm a working producer, and I'm a working musician still. I'm still a working musician, and I like to do my job, you know. I like to earn my bread, you know. I never got rich from the music business, man, you know.
Right.
You know, so I'm out there playing my trade, and one of the things of my trade is I can play guitar okay, you know, and people seem to like it when I do, and they seem to want me to play on their stuff. So if I like the music, if I think I can play something good on it, if it's something that I think I'm going to enjoy doing, it keeps me on my toes musically, keeps me being creative and playing music, and even when I'm swamped with production work. It makes the band happy and, right. You know, helps me buy a couple sandwiches.
Thanks for joining us. Hope you enjoyed part one of the James Murphy. Next time on Third Eye Cinema, James Murphy, talk to some Testament, equipment, car tech, going through a serious illness that causes his production. If you'd like to contact us here, comment, suggestions, or make email thirdeyecinema.com, website, Facebook page,
missed any part of this or any other Third Eye Cinema broadcast, just visit our website or Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Blog Talk Radio shows are available for archive listener download at your convenience. And, of course, next week.
Hi, this is James Murphy, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hi, this is James Murphy, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Stay classy, New York.
Grand Canyon University is Arizona's premier private Christian university, committed to providing next-generation education. GCU offers over 200 academic programs, many in high-demand fields, across 9 colleges. We keep our rigorous curriculum relevant by partnering with industry leaders and advisory boards. Earn your degree online, in the evening, or on our vibrant Phoenix campus. Find your purpose at GCU, where advanced technologies drive education. Private, Christian, affordable, nonprofit. Visit gcu.edu.